From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, turning everyday objects into colossal public monuments. We talk with sculptor Klaus Oldenburg. He created a giant clothespin for Philadelphia, a rubber stamp for Cleveland, and a fruit bowl for Miami. Malcolm X was born on this date in 1925. What did he have to say that relates to the urban riots that followed the Rodney King verdict? We'll talk with Claiborne Carson, who's written about both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And book critic John Leonard reviews Joan Didion's new collection of essays. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The State Department has condemned the violence in Thailand and called on both the government and opposition to show restraint. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said today, a normal relationship with the Thai government under current conditions will be impossible. She announced that the U.S. is suspending joint U.S.-Thai military exercises known as Cobra Gold. Most economic aid to Thailand was suspended last year when generals there mounted a coup d'etat. Today, the State Department said resumption of that assistance has been put on hold. However, U.S. aid for narcotics interdiction will continue. Tutwiler said today, as a longtime friend of the Thai people, we have made it clear that we cannot accept the use of deadly force as a means of resolving the issues that divide the opposition and the government. She said the U.S. Embassy in Bangkok has conveyed that message directly to the Prime Minister and to opposition leaders. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The Pentagon says it has gone to extraordinary lengths to supply British officials with information surrounding the friendly fire deaths of 9 British soldiers. They were killed by U.S. pilots at the end of Persian Gulf War last year. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said this was a terrible accident, deeply regretted by all concerned. He conceded that there are different versions of what actually happened, discrepancies between British and American accounts of the incident, but said the pilots who fired at what turned out to be British vehicles obviously believed they were shooting at the enemy at the time. If this had happened in the U.S., Williams said, the statements of the pilots would not have been made public as a matter of course or even released to investigating authorities. Sworn statements were provided to British authorities, and Williams said they already have everything available on this subject. There is no final answer as to why it happened, Williams said. It is an unfortunate accident of war, and the U.S. government considers the matter closed. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
A survey published by the Harvard School of Public Health finds growing support for euthanasia in the United States. The study is in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association. The researchers predict this support will result in continued efforts to legalize euthanasia in some form. The study said that in 1950, 34% of Americans thought doctors should be allowed to help end the lives of patients if they and their families requested it. The support grew in 1991 to 63%. The White House alleges that Japanese automakers are illegally dumping minivans on the United States market at artificially low prices. The Commerce Department defines the dumping margin as the percentage below what's charged for the same vehicle in Japan. The agency has singled out Mazda Motor Company and Toyota as the main culprits. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow gained nearly 22 points to close at 3397.99. This is NPR. The United Nations says it will fly food to hundreds of thousands of starving people in Mogadishu, Somalia's capital. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, will sponsor the flights to the city. Relief workers there estimate that 700,000 city residents are in precarious positions because they cannot get enough food. Drinking water is beginning to reappear in the city after a break of nearly 6 months, but the UN says that's not enough. Voter turnout in Oregon's presidential primary today has been light. Results of several close races won't be available until later this evening. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Morgan Holm reports.
County officials say voters turned out in large numbers when the polls opened at 7 this morning, but activity slowed later. In the Portland area, elections officials project a 54% turnout, while statewide, 53% of Oregon's registered voters are expected to cast ballots. Close contests are expected in the Democratic nominations for President and U.S. Senate. Republican candidates in those races face little opposition. A Portland city commissioner and a former Oregon House Speaker are in a tight race to succeed two-term Portland Mayor Bud Clark. 12 others are also on the ballot. If no candidate wins a majority, the top two vote-getters face a November runoff. The polls close at 8 p.m. Pacific time. For National Public Radio, I'm Morgan Holm in Portland, Oregon.
The House of Representatives has been urged to confirm the validity of the 27th Amendment to the Constitution, which was ratified this month, more than 200 years after being proposed. The amendment bars Congress from giving itself midterm pay raises. Some lawmakers say the new amendment may prevent Congress's receipt of the automatic cost of living increases already authorized. The U.S. Archivist ruled yesterday that the amendment was properly ratified by three-fourths of the states and is now a part of the Constitution. Some lawmakers still want Congress to validate the amendment since it took so long to ratify. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, the artist Klaus Oldenburg, once said, "I am for art that embroils itself in everyday crap and still comes out on top." Oldenburg and his wife and partner, Kosha van Bruggen, have designed a series of colossal public sculptures in the shapes of everyday objects. Cleveland has their giant rubber stamp. Miami has their fruit bowl, Chicago a giant baseball bat, Las Vegas has a flashlight. Their monuments have always been controversial, but as art critic Robert Hughes once wrote, no living artist combines the roles of magician and clown with as much skill as Oldenburg. His achievement has been to take an extraordinary range of banal objects and invest them with consistent metaphoric power. Oldenburg was born in Sweden but grew up in Chicago. Now Rizzoli has published a retrospective catalog of Oldenburg's multiples. One of Oldenburg's sculptures, a 45-foot-high clothespin, is across the street from City Hall in Philadelphia, where I live. It's easily my favorite public sculpture in the city. On even the most humdrum day, it brings wit and design into your life.
What you're experiencing, I think, would be one of the things that Kosh and I would be hoping for, is that it would do something in the landscape that would be different, would be surprising, and it's not always humorous, but I mean there's an element there, sometimes of the unexpected, which can be humorous, and the clothespin is an example of a sculpture that is quite formal. Some of the things we've done since then have been freer, but this one is very formal and very much like the structures in the city. So it's a kind of variation on a skyscraper, and its origin really goes back to a variation on a skyscraper in Chicago. That was a famous competition in 1922 for a design for the Tribune, Chicago Tribune Tower. And when the first drawing of the clothespin was made in 1967, it was made as a late submission to that competition. In other words, a variation, a kind of Gothic variation of the building that won the competition, which is, as you all know, a Gothic structure.
Although you've been doing these sculptures for years, they've never ceased becoming controversial. For instance, you designed a rubber stamp, and this was a commission for the Standard Oil headquarters in Cleveland. It was commissioned in 1985, but then British Petroleum bought Standard Oil, and they rejected the completed sculpture. Why did they reject it?
Well, they've never said exactly why they rejected it, but it probably had something to do with the fact that they didn't want to appear to be what they called a rubber stamp of the company they'd taken over. I suppose there's something about the name rubber stamp which has a negative connotation. Though that's not the way that Kosh and I see it. We see it as a normal, humble office object, just like a clothespin that can be subject for a sculpture. However, this particular stamp wasn't really known as the rubber stamp. It was known as the free stamp, and that's because on the stamp it said free. That was the concept from the beginning. So it went a little bit beyond the idea of enlarging a rubber stamp.
Do you think it violates the rules when a company buys another company and reneges on their commitment to buy the sculpture?
Well, it violates a contract we had, and of course that leaves us with very little option since we couldn't sue the company. But by a long process of citizen action, really, the sculpture came back as a sculpture for the city of Cleveland. And now it's no longer in front of a private building. It's next to the city hall, so it has a more universal application. So we feel that the end result of this 9-year process was really positive after all, and that the piece as it's now installed, which is on its side rather than standing up, is what was the destiny for the piece all along.
How tall is the rubber stamp now?
The free stamp.
The free stamp, yes.
Well, the free stamp is about 60 feet long. At this point, since it's lying on its side, right, we won't speak of it standing up. It rises from the ground about 25 feet, and then it lies about 60 feet.
You know, when it became a city monument instead of a corporate monument, it still got some angry reactions. I was reading some of the press coverage in Cleveland, and some of the columnists are saying, you know, what kind of art is this? Why do you think people get upset when an ordinary object is used as the subject of art?
Well, I don't know if that's what upsets people, but of course the tradition in public sculpture is to create something hierarchical, which is up on a pedestal, and people are perhaps surprised when that tradition is turned on its head, and you get instead a very simple object that most people probably don't feel belongs on a pedestal. But in modern times, it seems that such an object is more appropriate than, say, an equestrian statue. But people get angry for many reasons, and very often a public sculpture, because of its because it gets a lot of attention, is used by people to promote their own causes. And politicians will use it to make a case of some sort, which will call attention to themselves. I think it's very good that that people do discuss and raise controversies over sculptures. Kosha and I feel that it wouldn't be right somehow to put up something that everybody would agree on, that we have a responsibility as artists to practice the same approach that we do in private, which is to say to create something that has a bit of an edge, that lies a little bit ahead of general consciousness, or try to do that. So when that's transferred into public art, it does make people sometimes surprised, though they do get used to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about the controversy surrounding one other city sculpture that you did, and this was one for the city of Miami. It was called Drop Bowl with Scattered Slices and Peels. Let me ask you to describe it.
Well, the concept was of a bowl dropped into a plaza, a giant bowl, very large bowl, which contained slices of oranges and peels of oranges and some kind of a liquid, which wasn't exactly defined, that became the fountain element, the water element.
Mm-hmm.
And the bowl hit the plaza and scattered into seven pieces and seven fragments, and then the insides, what was inside, went flying out too. And this was all realized almost like a snapshot or a still moment of movement. And then it was realized in concrete and plastic and metal, and the water element was introduced. So what this was really was a translation of the traditional idea of a fountain, which usually has some kind of a bowl and figures in it, and it was taking that notion and sort of shattering it. This was Kosh's reaction to the situation there, which was a very formal situation that was forced on us. She said, well, why don't we just break the bowl and scatter the pieces? And that way the sculpture was less monolithic and it could take in a lot more space.
Now, part of the controversy around this particular piece was over the safety aspects of it. One person cut his leg after falling into one of the pools that catches the water from the fountain. Then a disabled rights group said that all the kind of jagged edges, all the edges, I should say, created a hazard for the blind. What was your reaction to that, and did you take those kinds of safety considerations into account when designing it?
Well, we met with various groups after the sculpture was put up, and we agreed on certain precautions.
Mm-hmm.
There are some buttons marking the edges of the sculpture, and other warning systems so that that issue is settled. I feel that in any public sculpture will be as dangerous as it is just to move around in the city. I know if you just, I was just on the street here in New York, and for 1 minute I didn't concentrate, and I nearly got clipped by a taxi. So I think that awareness like that is something you bring to your appreciation of a sculpture in the middle of the city. But, of course, there are special considerations for people who are handicapped and people who are blind. And we meet these considerations and discuss them and then do what we can.
So what's the status of that piece now? It's still up.
Well, that piece has been... It was closed briefly while they put in the safeguards, and mm-hmm. now it's been opened again. And I haven't seen it for a few months, but I get reports that it's in operating condition.
Is there much graffiti on any of your public sculpture? And I'm wondering if there is, how you feel about it, given your love of the kind of vitality of the city and everyday objects. You can make an argument that graffiti fits right into that.
Well, I think you could, but it really does interfere with the intentions of the sculpture. And it varies a great deal. Depends on the location and how much care is taken to keep the sculpture up. Of course, a public sculpture is a very prominent location, and for people who want to call attention to themselves, it's the best place to write. So it often does happen, but in most of the locations, there is attention to this detail. We were just in Barcelona, where we put up a large sculpture in the Olympics program, and there they are going to a lot of trouble to keep it painted. So I say it depends on the situation and the place.
Which sculpture has had the most graffiti?
Well, we have one that has reached a point of graffiti coverage where it has almost ceased to be a sculpture, and that's in Münster, Germany, where we created the pool balls, which are three concrete balls in a park in the middle of the city. And from the very beginning, these balls were used as bulletin boards, kind of, for the expression of personal and political feelings and posters and whatever. And we tried to scrape them down, but after a while we realized if we kept scraping, there'd be no sculpture left. So then we tried painting, but that didn't seem to do much good. So after a while, we just left it alone. And we look at them now as spherical billboards and have publicly disowned them as sculptures.
I'm interested in the roots of how you started doing these oversized, now colossal, sculptures of ordinary objects. You started doing this kind of work in much smaller versions, I believe it was in the early 1960s. What was on your mind then that led you in that direction?
Well, the first large-scale work was in 1969, which was the lipstick for Yale University. Before that, I'd been doing fantastic drawings of real sites, such as the clothespin I mentioned, where they were called proposed colossal monuments. Another one was the Good Humor Bar as a substitute for the Pan Am building on Park Avenue. And there were many situations like that were proposed where the existing building had something in common with something much smaller. Like Pan Am definitely has the shape of a Good Humor Bar, and the substitution was made in the media of drawing, and as convincingly as possible. But in 69, these drawings were well known to the students of architecture at Yale University. And when Herbert Marcuse, the socialist philosopher, came to lecture, they purposely asked him what would happen to society if some of these structures were built. And Marcuse replied that if that happened, then capitalist society would be at an end. So this stimulated the students to commission a sculpture on a large scale, a real version of these fantastic proposals. And so I got the commission to do a sculpture for the center of Yale University. And this was, of course, all done surreptitiously, and the authorities weren't asked. So the sculpture was prepared in secret and brought into Beinecke Plaza, which is the war memorial at the center of the university. And this was in the late 60s, and the mood, of course, was very combative, and the students were very involved. And it was a very exciting moment, and the authorities sort of decided to let it happen because they thought if they stepped in and prevented it, much worse things could occur. So the sculpture did get put up, and that was the first large-scale project.
My guest is sculptor Klaus Oldenburg. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Artist Klaus Oldenburg is my guest. What is it about ordinary objects that you take such pleasure in?
Well, I've always been very interested in deriving my art from my surroundings, from my daily experiences. And so my daily experiences are not very adventurous or dramatic. They tend to revolve around very simple things, just as most people's. And there came a moment when I saw these things as potential sculptures, razor blades, toothbrushes, soaps, whatever. I thought they have a certain character and identity and formal quality in themselves, which could be used as sculpture. And this was something which just came naturally. It also is important to me that I can touch all these things in a small scale, and I can feel the object completely, say, in a small scale before I proceed to making a large version of it. So it has very personal origins, which later became involved with the general practices of pop art and so on. But this interest in smaller objects had a personal origin.
Were you ever interested in a more classical, traditional art?
Well, I'm still interested in classical, traditional art, and the kind of art that I've done very often makes references to traditional art and tries to establish links with it. A large raisin bread, for example, has something in it of David's painting of Madame Récamier, things like that. There are allusions and references which try to connect the present with the past, which I think is a very important thing, not to lose history. That is to be in advance in some ways, but not to forget what's gone before.
Mm-hmm. We can see your art in public spaces, in Cleveland, in Philadelphia, in Miami, in many cities in Europe and the United States. Do you feel lucky in a way that you can make public sculpture, that one doesn't need to go inside a museum or a gallery to see your work? Is that the way you'd most like it to be?
Well, in 1978, when Kosch and I, after a brief period in Holland, moved back to America, we deliberately set out to put art outdoors and make it more accessible because we didn't like the gallery system where the artwork gets lost and goes into a vault and is never seen again and is seen, if at all, by very few people. So we wanted to create a work for more people and a work that participated with the real world. So we set out to do this series of large-scale projects. In 1985, we had come to the point where we thought perhaps it would be interesting to go back to some work that was more personal and more, say, gallery-oriented, because we were really losing touch with that part of the art scene.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that when you go into public art, you definitely cut yourself off from the art scene, because it's a very specialized activity. And you find that it's mostly reported in architecture magazines or in the daily press. And art magazines kind of go in another direction completely. But with the performance in Venice, Italy, of the Cotello, the Corso del Cotello, which Coscia had stimulated and which we did with the aid of many people in Italy, students and companies, the work went back to a smaller scale. And since then, we have been working inside of galleries as well as outside of galleries.
You live in Manhattan, in the Soho area.
That's right.
What do you see in the city that gives you the kind of excitement, the kind of delight, visual pleasure, irony, whatever that you hope your sculpture gives to other people? What do you see that gives you that feeling? That's either art or just happens to be there.
Well, in a city like New York, there's so many things, and there's so many moods, and there's so many different states of weather, and so many people. There's so much that it's very difficult to isolate anything. If Koshy and I concentrate on something, we finally manage to find some kind of a focus in a city for our thinking. In Des Moines, it was the umbrella. We have still not done anything for New York City, and it's a difficult city to do anything for, because there is it's really a lot here. I mean, the skyscrapers and the towers and the traffic and the many human beings. It's a little overwhelming, and you feel that perhaps the sculpture might get lost in all of it, and if you did do a sculpture, you couldn't summarize it somehow. It's just too big. There's another element about New York, and that is that it's in constant process, and one feels that that there's something inconsistent about a permanent work in the streets of New York. So I don't know. At one point, I had proposed a work that would be just a car on the subway, and it just would ride around underground, and it would just have a certain character of its own. And every time it would come into the station, there would be the monument. And some people might never see it at all, and some people might see it all too often, but it would always be in movement.
That's a lovely idea. I really like that.
Well, I think that New York is a place which makes you think about different solutions, which is one reason that it's nice to live here. It's a very tough city, but if you're in fortunate enough to be in a situation where you can observe it from a distance, then it's another matter.
Artist Klaus Oldenburg. Rizzoli has just published the book Klaus Oldenburg, Multiples in Retrospect, 1964 to 1990. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Malcolm X would have been 67 today. While Martin Luther King called for nonviolence, Malcolm X thought violence was sometimes the only language America understood. The Los Angeles riots may be a good example of that. Coming up, we remember Malcolm X and consider what his response might have been to the Rodney King verdict and its aftermath. We'll talk with Claiborne Carson, who has written about both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And book critic John Leonard reviews After Henry, a new collection of essays by Joan Didion. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Thailand, after several days of violence between police and anti-government protesters, residents of Bangkok are staying inside. Business in the capital city has closed its doors, and as Mary Kay Magstead reports, traffic is very light.
It's pretty eerie. The streets are completely quiet, and for a city of 8 million people with 2 million cars that are always jamming the roads, this is something that seems absolutely surreal. There are very heavily armed troops at various points in Bangkok. They've blocked off streets that lead to the area where the protests had occurred over the last couple of days, and they've been checking cars and checking anyone who's out after 6 o'clock, which was the declared curfew.
Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok. The State Department says it has told Thailand it cannot accept the use of deadly force as a means of resolving the issues that divide the opposition and government. A number of people have been killed and wounded in the violence, and thousands of people have been arrested. Protesters are calling for the ouster of the prime minister, but he has defended his government's use of force. In Washington, the government said today that housing starts dropped 17% last month for the biggest decline in 8 years. The Commerce Department says new housing starts were off in every part of the country. While experts had expected construction to be down last month after 4 advances, they had not expected so big a fall. However, at the same time, housing starts during the first 4 months of this year are over 30% above those at the same time last year. Guerrillas fired Katyusha rockets from South Lebanon toward Israel today. There have been no reports of casualties or damage. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The rockets came after weeks of quiet on Israel's northern border. Some of the rockets landed in the area of South Lebanon, Israel calls its security zone, and some landed on the border. In response, Israel shelled positions in South Lebanon, and there were reports of hundreds of civilians fleeing the area. The rockets came after Hezbollah guerrillas attacked an Israeli army post in South Lebanon. Reports from Lebanon said 4 soldiers of the Israel-backed South Lebanon army were killed in the attack and 2 others kidnapped. An Israeli army spokesman confirmed the incident but said he could not confirm the casualties. The Katyusha rocket attacks caused concern in Israel. A similar attack in February led to an Israeli incursion outside the security zone and caused thousands of Lebanese civilians to flee the area. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 22 points to close at 3,397.99, a record, on volume of over 189 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 9-7. This is NPR News. The Journal of the American Medical Association will publish an interview with the 2 doctors who performed the autopsy on President John F. Kennedy. The AMA says these doctors confirmed the findings of the Warren Commission on the Kennedy assassination. NPR's Maria Inahosa reports.
The editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, Dr. George Lundberg, said his interview with the 2 pathologists who conducted the Kennedy autopsy should put the Kennedy assassination conspiracy theories to rest. Lundberg, a former military pathologist, is the first to publish an interview with the 2 autopsy pathologists, who have been silent since the Kennedy assassination. In the interview, they said the president was killed by a shot wound to the head and another to the neck, both fired by a high-velocity rifle from behind. Lundberg called the movie JFK, which raised questions about the assassination, skillful film fiction. But Lundberg did say the autopsy findings and the pathologist interviews could not determine who fired the gunshots, whether there were shots that were fired and missed, or whether Lee Harvey Oswald worked independently with organized crime or with the CIA to plan the Kennedy assassination. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
Congressman Joe Kennedy spoke from the floor of the House today against the broadcasting last night by NBC of autopsy photos of President John F. Kennedy. Congressman Kennedy said his family has urged time and again that the autopsy pictures be kept private. He says to show these pictures on television does nothing to further the cause of the investigation into his uncle's murder. Kennedy said that he saw the photographs while watching the evening news with his two young sons. NBC had no comment. In Bosnia, a new ceasefire did not stop heavy shelling of Federal Army bases, thus blocking a planned pullout. Officials say that Federal Army troops are pinned down inside their barracks. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Malcolm X would have been 67 years old today. He was assassinated in 1965. While Martin Luther King preached nonviolence, Malcolm X said that violence was sometimes the only language the oppressor understood. What did Malcolm X say that might help us understand the violent response to the Rodney King verdict? We called Claiborne Carson, author of the books Malcolm X, the FBI File, and In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening of the 1960s. He's also the director and editor of the Martin Luther King Papers Project.
You know, Terry, one of the things that often happens with Malcolm is that the statements that are quoted most often have to do with his criticisms of nonviolence, and those are often brought forward whenever we have outbreaks of violence, like in recent days. But I think that the more enduring part of his message had to do with the development of institutions in the black community, and that part of the message is I think, vitally important today. He was calling for building up the black family, the social institutions, the religious institutions, the political institutions of the community, seeing that as the basis for any kind of gains that we might make in the future. His message is often called non-black nationalism, but I think that the most important aspects of it didn't have to really to do with the building of a new black nation, but the building of an institutional nation within American society. And so I think that would be the most important part of Malcolm's message.
Have you been thinking at all about if Malcolm X were alive, what he might have said in response to the King verdict and the L.A. riots?
Well, obviously he would be very angered by it. By the
verdict or the riots or both?
The verdict and trying to find some way of expressing that anger that so many of us felt in a manner that was constructive, that would lead to something positive. I think that's the real test of leadership, is when you get people frustrated and they want to be mobilized, and there's got to be something there for them to do that can lead to an advancement in their lives. And I think in some ways the leadership did not come through in the recent days. And I fault myself as much as anyone else, because you have to be credible. You have to have made the connections, particularly in the black community, before the crisis comes. And there wasn't a lot of credible leadership that could have led this into a nonviolent and constructive and yet militant channel, so that rather than destroying parts of the black community, that this could have led to something that would really enhance that community.
The Watts riots were the same year as the assassination of Malcolm X. Do you see any connection between Watts and the movement as defined by Malcolm?
Well, I was there in 1965, and what I recall, first of all, was just the surprise that it happened. You know, in 1965, we just weren't prepared for it. You know, I had been a civil rights activist, and at that time, I was affiliated with a group called NVAC. I recall, standing on Central Avenue, looking down down the street and seeing buildings in flame, and having that sudden sense that all of that militancy that we felt we had, we thought we were the most radical and militant of all the groups, and yet suddenly we felt that all of that militancy was kind of irrelevant in the new period that was starting with Watts. And I think after that, we were always searching for answers, and Malcolm appeared to offer the answer because he seemed to speak to that reality that we saw when parts of Los Angeles were burning down in 1965. But I think looking back, we took different parts of his message, and only over the years have we understood the full dimension of that message. I think what was easiest to take was his criticisms of nonviolence, because we were frustrated by that, by the limitations and by the way in which many white supporters of the civil rights movement used nonviolence as a criterion for whether they were going to support it at all, and kind of had this attitude that black people alone among all Americans should be restricted to the use of nonviolent tactics. We were determined to not accept that anymore. But I think that the question of violence versus nonviolence was only part of his message. And I think it took a longer time to begin to understand the other aspects of his message, the message about institutional development in the black community, the message about understanding the significance of African American history. Malcolm was one of the first great leaders, of mass leaders of the modern period, to study that history and to bring it into play in terms of his political message. So I think that over the last 27 years since his assassination, we've gradually incorporated more and more of Malcolm's message.
I want to get back to something that you were just saying, you know, that when in 1965 you were a member of a very militant group, but then during the Watts riots you started thinking this kind of militancy had become irrelevant. What made you feel that, irrelevant?
Well, you know, we had tried to organize people in the South Central L.A. during the years before the rebellion broke out, and it was hard going. It was hard to convince people, and we said that, you know, our form of nonviolence is not the same as King's. We were much more aggressive. We were much more determined to go up against the establishment. But when you saw the outpouring of popular support for what went on in August of 1965, the people out in the streets, all smiling, all participating in it, even the ones, a lot of them were not looting or participating in arson or anything like that, but they were clearly pleased by the fact that they had taken over the community and basically kicked the police out. And what became clear is that spontaneous event had mobilized black people to an extent that we had never succeeded in doing. And that's what made it seem like, you know, our approach, our strategy was just insufficient to meet the needs and the frustrations that people felt at that time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Claiborne Carson, author of Malcolm X, The FBI File, and he's also the editor of the Martin Luther King Papers Project. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Today is the birth date of Malcolm X, and I'm speaking with Claiborne Carson, who, among other things, has written the book Malcolm X, The FBI File. Malcolm X remains a very popular figure and a very important figure, and on the most superficial level, you could see that importance reflected in the number of Malcolm X posters and Malcolm X hats around. Is there anything else you would like to have us think about on this date, which is the birth date of Malcolm X?
Well, I think the enduring part of Malcolm's message and the significance of his life have to do with the fact that he was a person who came out of the worst aspects of the black experience in America. When you compare him to King, King had a lot of the privileges of being brought up in a middle-class environment in which he had a lot of advantages. Malcolm didn't have those advantages. His life exposed him not to the American dream, but the American nightmare. He was a person who kind of started at the bottom. He was at the bottom of his life, indeed, when he was in prison and when he discovered the message of the Nation of Islam. And I think that when we see how he pulled his life together and began to understand the intelligence and the creativity and the energy and the drive that he had, and began to put it to use, not to get himself rich or to move ahead as an individual, but to help his people get ahead. I think that is an inspiring message, and it's one that has particular significance for us today, because there is a part of the black community that has not benefited from the gains of the 1960s, that is still at the bottom of the American social order, that has very little hope. And when people in that group look to Malcolm and look at his life, they can see something that represents a possibility for themselves, much more than, say, looking to King or looking to the nationally visible black leadership. He is somebody who comes out of the experience that many black people share, and it's the being exposed to the vicious aspects of American society, and yet being able to prevail over that.
You know, what you're saying reminds me of something that I know I was thinking, I'm sure a lot of people were thinking, watching Ted Koppel's interviews with some of the gang leaders in Los Angeles. You couldn't help but think about how smart some of them were and what really good leaders they'd make they're already good leaders, but they're leaders in this kind of underground, you know, they're leaders of gangs. But you wonder if they had more options open to them and if they weren't forced into this kind of underground.
That's the tragedy of American life. I mean, we have allowed over the last 20-some years, we've lost a generation of people whose talents have been thrown into the gutter because they've been given poor schools. The health care in the black community has been allowed to deteriorate. Drugs have been allowed to come into the community and destroy all of that potential that is there. And I think that's what we have to begin to reverse, is that we can't throw away the potential of a significant part of this society and still think that the society is not going to suffer for that. We are, as a nation, need to take responsibility for this. And I think that the notion that somehow there are these talented individuals who are appearing on TV now that they've drawn attention to themselves, but they'll disappear very quickly, and they'll just go back to being obscure individuals, unless the society as a whole understands that's a talent, that's that kind of energy that can go into keeping a drug-related organization alive for over a decade that involves many hundreds and perhaps thousands of individuals, that's a talent that needs to be tapped for more constructive purposes. And I think that if we can do that as a society, the society as a whole will be stronger. If we don't do it, the entire society is going to go down the drain.
You know, this reminds me of something else that Malcolm X said about the chickens coming home to roost. I mean, I think really one of the lessons of the LA riots is that when there's a lot of poverty and despair in a culture, it affects everybody. You know, you're not going to be free of it, even if you're middle class or if you're affluent. It's going to come back and affect you.
Well, I think that part of the problem has been that there is this very strong, widely shared illusion that you can create an island of affluence that separates you from the problems of the inner city. And many Americans still believe that they can get their house in the suburbs, that they can not pay taxes to build up the inner cities, that they can forget about the problems of the public schools, that those don't matter for them because they've got theirs and the rest of the society can go to hell. You know, I think that this kind of an assumption, this kind of an attitude, has been at the root of what's brought us to this point where we are two societies, one affluent and one poor, and the gulf between them is getting larger and larger. So I think that's something that, you know, when Malcolm was talking about the chickens coming home to roost, you know, I think there is that sense that someday they will. The question is whether that will take so long that when they do come home to roost, it will be an explosion of violence that will dwarf anything that we've had before. I think that there is a real danger in this country that we're so out of touch with the realities that are facing poor people in the inner cities, that we really assume that people are going to accept that forever, that they will allow their lives to be destroyed without fighting back. And that's never happened with any people in the world, and I don't think it's going to happen with the people in the inner cities. And I think that, if anything, the violence in L.A. is a warning signal. You know, we talked once in this country about the fire bell in the night that was the warning that the Civil War was coming. And I think that we're getting the same kinds of warning signals, that we cannot continue to allow this society to be as divided as it is over issues of economics and class without paying the price ultimately.
Claiborne Carson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Claiborne Carson is a professor of history at Stanford University and the author of Malcolm X, The FBI File. He's also the editor of the Martin Luther King Papers Project. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we are going to take a look at two places in the world which are violent today, Thailand and Yugoslavia, and in Thailand explore, among other things, besides what's happening now, the middle-class nature of the people who are rioting in Bangkok. And in Yugoslavia, talk to a longtime diplomat about why it's happening and why the violence in Yugoslavia cannot be stopped by any of the European countries. We'll also take a good look at who has been arrested as a result of the Los Angeles riots and look back at the aftermath of a similar situation in Florida in the Metro Dade police force.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Joan Didion has been writing about the personal and the political since the late 50s. Her novels include Play It As It Lays, Democracy, and Book of Common Prayer. Her essays have been collected in the books Slouching Toward Bethlehem and The White Album. She's also written about El Salvador and the Cuban community in Miami. Joan Didion has a new collection of essays called After Henry. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
I've been reading Joan Didion for more than 30 years. From her early days at Vogue and National Review, through the middle period in Esquire and Life, to the Augustan Imperial essays for The New Yorker and the New York Review of Books, with the novels crouching here and there in the blank uneasiness, like griffins, lion-colored, eagle-eyed. I've said variously that she writes with a razor, stings like a scorpion, registers like an early warning system or a seismograph, every tremor on the fault line of the culture, all our paranoid vibrations. It's a hard style to describe, much less approximate, part movies and part desert, and full of nameless blue-eyed dread, like the pop art you find at the Temporary Contemporary in Los Angeles, past the kosher burrito stand, so many spiders, somehow gaudy, in the sand. But a style also bi-coastal, Western spaces and New York drop-dead smarty pants. It's as if she paints a bruise. Her motion has been from the personal to the political, from a third world of women to third worlds like El Salvador and Cuban Miami, to the burning towers and broken tile of our own politics. She doesn't exactly whistle in these bare-ruined choirs. She's waiting for the big one, a Manson or a Quake, for the fire to come down from the hills to Malibu, for cannibals to eat New York. Meanwhile, brilliantly, she deconstructs. Deconstruction is really disenchantment. In After Henry, Didion is deconstructing what she calls the narratives of Washington, California, and New York. Narratives, she says, are lies we tell each other to get us through the night. Although everywhere we look is what she calls some tropism toward disorder, yet we tell each other pretty stories about Nancy Reagan and Patty Hearst, Mayor Tom Bradley in the Los Angeles Times, Hollywood writers on strike and New York demagogues on the late night news, nuclear reactors in Berkeley, boat people in Hong Kong, and joggers in Central Park. Didion and her husband have just moved back to New York, and she seems to be wondering why, since the New York narrative about itself is so sentimental as to be surreal, especially in the Central Park jogger case. On the other hand, she was writing before Los Angeles went up in flames. Maybe there's something to be said, after all, for the gorgeous mosaic sentimental narrative of a David Dinkins versus the business and bulldozers bulletins of a Tom Bradley. Never mind. Did you know that white New Yorkers are in less mortal danger today than they were 15 years ago? Didion tells us that the number of white murder victims in my city has steadily declined from 361 in 1977 to 190 in 1989. I read four New York newspapers every morning, and I didn't know this, and I should have. Just as I should have known that Ronald and Nancy Reagan have never paid for a house of their own, that Los Angeles itself is afloat financially only because of motion pictures, junk bonds, and the stealth bomber, and that big city parks, even in London, even in Paris, have been very dangerous places after dark, at least since the 19th century. There are more subordinate clauses in Didion's style than there used to be, because the reporter in her makes life difficult for the impressionist, but she's just as lucid, just as eerie, the ice queen of our disenchantment.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed After Henry, a new collection of essays by Joan Didion. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet, with Sue Spolin, Sue Weinstein, and Dorothy Farabee. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the toxic legacy of the U.S. military. We'll talk with science writer Seth Shulman, who has investigated toxic waste in military bases all across the country. His new book is The Threat at Home. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.